Well, good morning. Shall we begin? Illumine our hearts, O Master who loves mankind, with the pure light of your divine knowledge. Open the eyes of our mind to the understanding of your gospel teachings. Implant also in us the fear of your blessed commandments, that trampling down all carnal desires, we may enter upon a spiritual manner of living, both thinking and doing such things as are well-pleasing unto you. For you are the illumination of our souls and bodies, O Christ our God, and unto you do we send up glory, together with your Father, who is without beginning, and your all holy, good, and life-creating Spirit, now and ever and unto ages of ages. Amen. Good morning. Today is the fourth Sunday of Great Lent, and the particular commemoration that we have today is for St. John of the Ladder, or St. John Climacus. Climacus is a Latinization of the Greek word climax, or climax, which is Greek for ladder, if you didn't know. And in Latin, it's scala, by the way, so you know the La Scala, the opera, is usually stairs or a ladder is what's mentioned. But it is the composition of the abbot of St. Catherine's Monastery on Sinai. John went to the monastery as best we can figure. The details of his life are sketchy. He was about 16 years old when he went to the monastery. And his spiritual father there was Mercurius, I think, or Martyrius I. And he was a disciple of his for a number of years. When he reached a degree of maturity, he asked to be allowed to go live as a hermit. So he lived in a cave at the base of Mount Sinai, about, I think it's a half a mile or so from the main monastery itself, and he would come back on the weekends for services, but lived in a cave where he studied the lives of the saints and read the fathers, and so really gained a great deal of wisdom and insight. When he was elderly, about 75, he was asked by the Brotherhood to become the abbot of the monastery, and so he became the abbot, and he died in that capacity. Sometime toward the end of his life, I don't know if it was after he, I think it was after he was made abbot, a brother abbot from the monastery of Raithu, which is on the coast near Tyre and Sidon, wrote to him and said, "I'm abbot of this monastery over here. I need some help. How do I lead my monks in the way of salvation? Send me something to help." And so he wrote The Ladder. And what The Ladder is a nice book, by the way. It's a good edition. The Ladder is a book in 30 chapters. You know, yes, sir. He may have, or at least somewhere. Again, the sketches of his life are a little hazy, but somewhere towards, certainly in the maturity of his years, he wrote it. And there is, because there's a prefatory letter, you know, John, the abbot of Sinai, to my brother John, abbot of Raithu. So the presumption is he was already the abbot of Sinai when he wrote this. Or maybe he wrote it a little earlier and said, "Oh, John wants something here. I have this. Let me send this off to him." So it may be something like that, but definitely the letter is, you know, comes from late in his life. But it's a book in 30 chapters, and he mimicked, or he took as the sort of the paradigm that he's working on, the ladder that Jacob saw in his vision. When he fell asleep, he put the rock under his head, and he saw a ladder that went up to heaven, and the angels of the Lord ascending and descending on the ladder. So that was the image that he used. And he described for monks the stages of spiritual growth in order that they needed to attain in order to get to holiness and to sanctity. And so instead of chapters, he called them steps or rungs on the way up the ladder. And in good monastic literature, it's a collection of very brief, mostly very brief little aphorisms and brief paragraphs, some of them extremely pithy, about each of the subjects that he talks about. So there are, that's the general framework. The book falls into basically three sections. The first seven steps or rungs of the ladder are about the basic virtues that you need in order to lead the ascetical life, to be a monk. The next 19 steps are all about overcoming different vices and passions and how to build virtues in their places. And then the final four steps, 27 through 30, concern the higher virtues towards which the monastic life aims. So it concerns stillness, or hezekia, prayer, prosevhi, dispassion, apatheia, and finally, the linking of all of the virtues together, the last step, is on love. And so that's the way he concludes it. Like I say, he sent the manuscript over to a neighboring monastery. It didn't just stay there. It was extremely popular. John is writing, he lives in the late 6th, early 7th century. And so monasteries are well established all over the Byzantine world. And copies of this go everywhere. It becomes sort of a bestseller of its day in the monastic communities. It's translated into Latin. It makes its way into Latin monasteries in the West. And it is so popular, particularly among the Orthodox, that during Great Lent, it is appointed to be read at the refectory in the dining hall every day during Great Lent. And so if you go to any Orthodox monastery now, either at lunch or dinner, whatever time it is that the monks read from the fathers, they will be reading the Ladder of Divine Ascent while the monks have their meals. It's also read in church as part of the daily office. On Lenten weekdays, it's prescribed that way in the Triodion. Frankly, I don't know exactly when it's appointed to be read, probably like at the first or the third or the ninth hour or something like that, a portion is to be read. So it is foundational for monastic life, and it is a foundational text for Orthodox spirituality. It is not that hard to read, to be perfectly honest. Some parts of it, you know, especially the later chapters, kind of go right over your head. And some parts certainly don't apply because we're not monks. But a lot of the advice and a lot of the observation, the psychological insight that this guy had on just human life and behavior and the way sin works and the way the passions and the demons work and all of that is really very good and very helpful. So in some years past, when I had myself a little more together and I sent out daily Lenten thoughts to you in the congregation, one year it was all selections from the Ladder of Divine Ascent. People really loved those. So what I will do is we'll come back to the book, and I'll give you some of the passages out of it that I found particularly meaningful. But before I get to that, I tell you, we'll look at the icon, and I'll explain the icon to you because it's got some detail in there that maybe you have missed. And then we'll talk about some of the passages from the latter. And class will, of necessity, be a little bit short today, because there are, I think, 5 children who are looking to make their first confession here in a couple of weeks' time, and the teacher said that it would be helpful if Father Michael sat and talked with them and showed them the confessional and all. I guess a couple of them have a little trepidation about the whole thing, so I'm going to do what I can to put their hearts at peace. If any of you adults are still scared of confession, maybe feel free to come and sit with the children, and I'll do what I can to assuage your fears as well. Okay? Let me fetch the icon here. If you have the Sunday Bulletin in your hands, there's another version, very similar. The format of the icon is pretty standard. It has a few different details to it. But, you know, here, I'll tell you what, I just want to back and have a quick look at it, and I'll just point out a few things. Notice particularly St. John at the bottom of the ladder, the monks going up and down, the demons who are there on one side pulling people away, the angels on the other side kind of helping people up, and Christ at the top, which is at the top of the ladder. Those of you who are close, you can see when I get up here. And then at the very top of the icon is, in fact, paradise. So that's the way the thing is set out. Down here at the bottom corner, even on the one on the bulletin, is St. John himself with a little scroll. I don't know what the little scroll says, but he's pointing toward the ladder. You see? Okay. So he's pointing towards the ladder to which all of the monks are ascending. And in this particular one, it's all monks, because again, he wrote the book primarily for monks. And so there are monks who are climbing up the ladder, step by step, making progress in virtue. On the one side, we have a group of angels flying around, all being encouraging and helping the people out there. And on the other side, you have a bunch of demons who are black, and they've got wings, and they look like little devils. And I tell you this, one of the interesting things about iconography, and it's something that's always, you can always see, is that in every icon, and you look at the ones around the church, even when people are sort of turned sideways, like here that, you know, Panagi and John the Baptist are looking at Jesus here, you still see three quarters of their faces. You still see both eyes. You never have an exact half profile in an icon, okay? The only time you have that are with demons, and they're always shown in half profile. So here, all these little demons you see flying around are perfectly sideways, and you only see half their faces. But they have ropes, and one of them's got one of the monks by the leg, I think, in this icon. Others have bows and arrows. They're shooting. You know, this goes back to the Psalms, you know, that we ask for God to quench the fiery darts of the evil one that are hurled at us, because they're always hurling little darts of passions and unclean thoughts at us and firing those at us into our hearts. So the demons are attacking the monks. And this particular icon, the ratio of monks who are making it up the ladder to monks who have fallen off is not real good. It's about 2 to 1. And so a lot of monks are falling here. And it's sobering in that respect. You know, we have to watch ourselves. Is it possible for us to lose our salvation? Sure it is. Sure it is. And we need to be careful. Be wary of what it is that the devils do to us. Be conscious of the fact that the angels are here to help us. At the bottom corner of the icon, in both the bulletin and this one, you'll see there's a mouth with great big teeth. Sorry, I got to do the, you know, the rabbit from Monty Python, the Holy Grail. There, but there is a mouth with great big teeth, and it's the mouth of hell. And you see in the icons, I think even in the one there, there's already a monk being swallowed up. You know, so someone has even been lost. You know, it's possible to fall off and to get back on the ladder, but you know, it's also possible to fall and never to rise again. So you have to be careful of that. And then at the top of the ladder, up here is Christ. I think there's Christ up there. Yes. Receiving monks into paradise. So someone who has succeeded in ascending the ladder and has left this life in holiness arrives with Christ. And then at the very top, and this is, I know this is in the on your bulletin as well, are images of paradise. And on the large icon we have here, the seraph in the corner, if you see there's actually a couple of steps below the seraph, so he's still, the flaming sword is guarding the gates of paradise up here. But we also have a man holding a cross, a large cross. That's the good thief, because Jesus says to him, today you will be with me in paradise. So that's the good thief, the repentant thief who is up there. And in this particular icon, it has John the Baptist and the Theotokos, who are interceding for the people who are, you know, on the spiritual journey. I think on the icon of the bulletin, there is an image of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob sitting down together at the banquet in paradise. And there's also a little icon or image of the Holy Trinity up there in heaven. So that varies a little bit, but that's sort of the fundamental sort of aspects of the icon here. Okay, if you want, you take a closer look at that.
I think it's very nice that the monks are very colorfully dressed in this particular icon. No monk is going to be caught wearing blue and red and all that, but it's very normal. Also, St. Nikolai Milimirovich, his icon is out because today is his feast day, and since he's one of our North American saints, we put him on for our prayer.
So there's a little bit about John. There's a little bit about the structure of the book. There's a little bit about his icon. What are some of the kinds of things that he says in the Ladder of Divine Ascent? He'll say things like this. Those who enter this contest, in this case he's talking about monastic life, must renounce all things, despise all things, deride all things, and shake off all things that they may lay a firm foundation. A good foundation of three layers and three pillars is innocence, fasting, and temperance. Let all the babies in Christ begin with these virtues. So if you want to lay a beginning yourself, you need to do it with innocence, all right? Which means not, you know, heady intellectual sophistication, not worldly sophistication or I know better than anything else, but very simple, in fact, simplicity and innocence, fasting and temperance, meaning being moderate in all things. So if you spend too much time in front of the television or in front of the computer or whatever else, you know, or you drink too much or whatever it is that you do too much of, you need to be moderate if you're going to make a foundation. But if you do those things, if you are innocent, you fast, and you're temperate, you can begin there and you can lay a good foundation. Then he goes on to say, this is all on step one or chapter one, to lag in the fight at the very beginning of the struggle and thereby to furnish a token of our coming slaughter is a very hateful and dangerous thing. A firm beginning will certainly be useful for us when later we grow slack. So, it's like when we started Great Lent. Did we start strong? Did we start with good intention? Or did we just sort of, I'll just sort of ease my way into it a little bit, you know, and see how it goes. Because if you did that, you gave evidence of your coming slaughter. Because by Wednesday, you are already undone. And certainly after the first week, you know, you're already undone. So yeah, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to struggle with Christ, if you're going to work out your salvation, you know, jump in with both feet. You know, like St. Paul says, leave the old rags to lie, throw off the old man. You know, run the course of the, you know, the spiritual life sincerely, and don't do it half-heartedly. Because if you do it half-heartedly already, the devil sees, this one's not serious. He'll be quick to take out, and sure enough, we get taken out quick. So, don't give tokens of your coming slaughter at the very beginning, all right? He goes on. When the soul betrays itself and loses its fervor, and here we are 4 weeks into Lent, and have we lost our fervor? Maybe some of, we've kind of started well, but it is getting long by now, I agree. But when the soul betrays itself and loses its fervor, let it carefully investigate the reason for losing it. Let it arm itself with all its longing and zeal against whatever has caused it. For the earlier fervor can return only through the same door through which it was lost. So if you started out well with fasting, but you kind of threw in the rag on that, you need to go back to fasting. You know, if you started out really well and you said, no, I'm not going to give in to social media, I'm going to turn off that kind of stuff, I'm not getting in it, and we've been lulled back into it and drawn back in, we need to cut that all off again, okay? So look and see whatever it was that caused you to fall, and you need to go back out that, you know, the same way, all right? And this is good also, the next one, for general instruction, for, you know, for Great Lent and for anyone coming to Christ. In the very beginning of our renunciation, it is certainly with labor and grief that we practice the virtues. I don't know anybody who does like the first 3 or 4 days of Great Lent and starts the fast who finds it easy. You know, you give up the sugar, you give up the things you usually eat, you quit eating so much, you give up quite so much coffee. You have a headache, you know, you find yourself a little crabby, you're having sugar withdrawals, you know, whatever it is your particular issue is, you start having it. No, it's never easy at the beginning. Or if you decide you're not going to turn on your social media, what happens? You know, you sit down on the couch with a cup of tea and you open the laptop, you say, what am I doing? This is what I always do. Okay, that's the habit, so okay, we got to shut the laptop, you know, not going to go there. And we say, well, now what am I going to do with myself? And we have to figure out something else to do. And you say, I got nothing. So I'll read news instead of looking at Facebook. That's what I'll do. And so you spend the next 90 minutes cruising, you know, clicking on news sites, you know, instead, as if that's any better for us. But, you know, no one starts at the very beginning. It is with labor and grief that we practice the virtues. But when we've made progress in them, we no longer feel sorrow, or we only feel a little sorrow. But as soon as our mortal mind is consumed and mastered by our zeal, we practice the virtues with joy and eagerness, with love and with divine fire. And it's true. You know, once we sort of get in the habit of living a spiritual life, you know, we start reading the scriptures and we say, what the hell does this mean? I don't understand this. You say, okay, well, I'm going to stick with it. And the next day we read a little more and we read a little more and we find out, oh, it actually does make a little sense. oh, I knew this. This actually means, speaks to me. This says something. I needed to hear this. I'm glad I read this today. And then it gets to where we start looking forward to it. And then we're sorry we only read as little as we do, and we really want to read more. And we make time to read a little more and all. So things that we do, especially things that are good for us, once we begin practicing them, we find they get easier. So don't lag. Don't give up hope yet, even if things are still difficult and we have to slog through parts of our spiritual life. That's okay. We can still keep up. All right? There's a very famous passage that that gets repeated often because it applies to so much, so many of us. It says, some people living carelessly in the world came to me. All right, so some lay people are visiting the monastery, and they say, okay, they say, we have wives, we're beset with social cares. How can we lead the solitary life? You know, this monastic life is so beautiful. You're making progress. You know, you're overcoming your passions. You're loving Christ. This is beautiful, but I got to work 9 to 5. What can I do? So he tells them, do all the good you can. Don't speak evil of anybody. Don't steal from anybody. Don't lie to anybody. Don't be arrogant toward anybody. Don't hate anyone. Don't be absent from the divine services. Be compassionate to the needy. Don't offend anyone. Don't wreck another man's domestic happiness, and be happy with what your own wives can give you. If you behave like this, you will not be far from the kingdom of heaven. Okay? Please notice that when St. John is talking to people living in the world, he doesn't tell them to spend 3 hours a day saying the Jesus prayer. He doesn't tell them to fast until they faint. He doesn't tell them to spend every waking hour in services. What he tells them is how to live an active Christian life in the world. And most of his advice is, if you will, active, it's stuff you do, and how you can live in relationship with other people, okay? So, you know, this is, and I mentioned this in particular because a whole lot of Orthodox spiritual literature was written by monks, and some of the best stuff was written for monks as well. And if we're not careful in reading that, we think that it all applies to us in our own life, living in the world, and it doesn't. And so sometimes people get discouraged by that. Or you get, like me, when I was young and full of zeal, you know, and I was reading all of this stuff, and I says, wow, I want to do all of this. And you can't do all of that. You know, I have to get up and, you know, and go work. At the, you know, I was drawing blood every morning at the hospital. You can't get up and spend 2 hours of prayer. I'd be up at 1 o'clock in the morning if I was going to spend 2 hours saying Jesus prayer before I went to work every morning. I had to be there at 4:30. You know, it's just impossible. So, you know, we learn to take what's here and apply it to our own situation in ways that's helpful to us. Yeah, Harry.
Could you say that 4 volumes
of the Philokalia
is most of it,
or all
of it,
are of that nature, and
it's written by
monks? Oh, yes. The Philokalia is yes. Yeah. Yes, the Philokalia is a collection of monastic writings from the 4th to the 14th century. It was compiled by St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mountain in the 18th century. It is, the way I heard it called, the Philokalia is graduate school spirituality. Yeah, I do not recommend any of you start with the Philokalia, okay? In fact, I know that Father Igumen Joseph, who's the abbot of the monastery of St. Gregory Palamas down in Ohio, who was my spiritual father while I was in Ohio, his monks, all of the monks in his monastery, had a blessing to read volume 1. They were not allowed to read 2, 3, or 4. Just beyond them. So, do not, yes, I would not read the Philokalia. If you want to know where to start in spiritual literature, the latter is not a bad place to start. Like I say, it's a little chewy at times, but by and large, it's a good place to start. The easiest, and really, if you want to read classical Orthodox spiritual literature, start with the Sayings of the Desert Fathers. That's like one of the most approachable, easiest things to read. Just, it's called the Alphabetical Collection of the Sayings of the Desert Fathers. It's alphabetical because it's just a collection. It starts with, like, Abba Anthony. you know, and then Abba Anthony, then Abba Arsenius, and it starts all the fathers that start with A. Then it goes to Basil and Barsanuphius and all. Then it goes to, you know, Gammon, and it just goes through. So it's just this collection of these sayings of the Desert Fathers, and they're not bad. I would start there. I would start with, for a little more contemporary stuff, a few weeks ago in the Journey to Great Lent section in the Sunday Bulletin, I recommended three or four books that I thought were very good. And Tito Caliander's Way of the Ascetics is very brief. It's like 30 little brief chapters. It won't take you a minute, 90 seconds to read each one. They're like little daily meditations. They are based on the Ladder and the Philokalia, but they're very simply put. But if you read other literature later, you realize just how deep and how grounded Caliander's little explanations are. That's very good. I'd think about it, but yeah, it's depending on your Lives of Saints are always very good. They're edifying very often. You know, there's some good wisdom to be had in there. And there's some really nice ones that have been published more recently that include a lot of teaching as well. So, yeah, but I would not start with the Philokalia. Okay. Yes, and if you have it and want to donate your copy to the parish library, it might be well. To admire the labor of the saints is good. To emulate them wins salvation. But to wish suddenly to imitate their life in every point is unreasonable and impossible. So it's okay if we don't do everything that the saints do all at once. Okay, we'll manage. It'll be okay. Here's one for those of us who like to argue. He whose will and desire in conversation is to establish his own opinion, even though what he says is true, should recognize that he is sick with the devil's disease. So, if you're in conversation, you really want to prove that you're right and get your point across, even if you're right. If you're being forceful with your opinion and you have to have your say and your way, know that you're sick with the devil's disease, because he had to have his way and he had to have his say. Okay? So we have to be careful. Nothing causes fruitlessness like impatience. So if you find you're not having any fruit, it may be because you're impatient yet. Patience, patience, patience. Always. Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'll go over to the kids here in just a minute. Being warred against is a sign that we're making war ourselves. So if you find you're having spiritual warfare, if the devil's after you, if things aren't going well, if you're having a difficulty getting through your prayer rule, or things are getting in the way in the morning when you get up to pray, or the telephone rings when you go to say your prayers at night, or all of your friends invite you out to steak, you know, for lunch, you know, on Wednesday when you're getting ready to come to pre-sanctify, know that the devil is warring against you. Others of the fathers tell us this too. If you're never tempted or bothered by the devil, it's probably because he's got you in his pocket. He doesn't need to tempt you if he's already got you. Okay? If he's fighting against you, then you're making an effort and you're causing him grief. So, if you got troubles, you got tribulations, that's not necessarily a bad sign. It may, in fact, be a good sign that you're doing something right that the devil doesn't like. Okay? This one was for me, so I put it in here for myself. It is certainly a mark of hot temper when a person continues to quarrel and rage against his offender, both by words and gestures, even when he's by himself. So if you're one of those who drives down the road, gripping the steering wheel with white knuckles, muttering under your breath about the blankety blank 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 who did blankety blank blank to you, you got a hot temper. All right? Even if you're right. It's worse if you're right. Yes, yes. See? You see how it works. You see how it works. The flesh is an ungrateful and treacherous friend. The more you care for it, the more it injures you. Okay? And a very, very famous, I think, I think one of the most famous things that he says is quoted most often from the latter. Flog your enemies with the name of Jesus, for there is no stronger weapon in heaven or on earth. And that's a clear reference to the Jesus prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, sinner. Flog your enemies with the name of Jesus. That's the best weapon that we've got. So that and the sign of the cross will do it. All right? And for those who need encouragement to pray in the morning, and this is one of the reasons why I spend most of my prayer time in the morning, it says, devote the first fruits of your day to the Lord, because the whole day will belong to whomever gets the first start. So if you'll get up in the morning and say your prayers, even if it's just brief, even if it's just very brief, but if the first thing, substantive thing, you know, get up, empty your bladder, brush your teeth, wash your face, make your cup of coffee if you have to. You know, Jesus and I always have coffee in the morning together. I always say my prayer with a cup of coffee in hand. It's fine. I have no objection to that. But the first substantive thing I do is I light my limpada in front of my icons. I take out my prayer book, and I say my prayers, and I sing the psalms to the Lord. And then I make intercession for all of y'all. And if I do that first thing in the morning, it does not matter what else happens the rest of the day, or if the whole day goes completely off the rails. Somehow I manage to handle it, and I come out on top. But if I miss my morning prayers, if I miss that routine, and the day goes off the rails, I'm sunk. And that's when I'm driving down the road, grinding my teeth and complaining about people, and, you know, cursing under my breath and muttering, and everything else falls apart. So devote the first fruits of your day to the Lord. Give him the very first. And if you do that, the rest of the day will belong to him as well, and you'll be okay. All right? So there's wisdom like this, you know, that's there in the ladder. I was reading another passage this morning that I just sometimes, he has a really nice way with imagery. In the chapter on humility, for example, he says something along the lines of, you know, it is the nature of the lemon tree that its branches always go upwards, except when it's laden with fruit. Let the person who reads understand. And you say, oh, what is this? Okay, it's our nature to want to go up too. But if we, what happens when a fruit tree is laden with fruit? What happens to the branches? They bend down. And the more fruit, the heavier the fruit, the more the branches bend down. So the more fruit that there is, the more humble the tree. It's the same with us. So if we're proud and arrogant, we probably don't have a whole lot of fruit. But if we do have some fruit, we'll find that humility will probably take care of itself. So if we seek for spiritual fruit, if we seek for mercy and forgiveness and peace and love and forbearance with our neighbors and all of that, then we'll find, you know, we'll also have humility as well. So, at any rate, the ladder is, I say, there's a classic there. There's a few little samples out of it. If you're ever looking for something really to chew on that would be good, it's not a bad one to start with. All right? Okay, forgive me. I need to go and I got to talk to these kids about confession now.